Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour on Editorial Week. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Genesis Flood, right after this. Well, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been developed by simply projecting all the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. That way, catastrophes like Noah's flood are strictly ruled out. And this process, by the way, is called science. Now listen to this. The sun is shrinking. It's a Newswire report, and it made the surprising statement that the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years, and the evidence is now conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking about 5 feet. If the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. And only 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent from the origin of the sun. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? Wasn't that 65 million years ago? Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the arithmetic on this kind of pseudo-scientific lie. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the license of science. And this is just one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct here in Isabella, Missouri. For more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Genesis Flood, the real science behind geology. It came from a flood, and the facts of science and geology prove it. So we talked about the universal flood, not the local flood theory, but the worldwide inundation of every square foot on planet Earth, from the North Pole to the South Pole, and from Russia around the world back to Russia again. Then we talked about the size and capacity of the ark. Was it big enough to hold all those animals? We found out that not only was it big enough, it only took 1/7 of the space in the ark to house the animals. Caring for the animals, we talked about, could 8 people feed and carry the manure away for 35,000 animals for 371 days. And then the arithmetic of uniformitarianism. We talked about that last time. Now let's take a look at modern geology and the flood. Because today, if you go to college and we talk about geology, and we talk about geology and in the same breath we mention the Genesis flood, Noah's flood, the worldwide flood in the same voice or in the same breath, people look at you like, where did this jerk come from? He must be Mork from Ork. This guy is totally divorced from reality. I run across that from time to time, and I'd like to share some of the answers with you. If you've been a little timid to take on the evolutionists and the uniformitarianists, well, let's listen to the facts of science, not the power of suggestion, not the constant propaganda that has no sufficient or does not have sufficient or has, in reality, no real scientific facts to back it up. A lot of supposition, a lot of guesstimates, a lot of assuming facts not in evidence, a lot of hearsay, a lot of propaganda, but no hard science. Now let's take a look at real science. You know, the flood was once believed to be the explanation for most of the phenomena that we observe in geology. Later, it was regarded as one of a series of geological cataclysms which were the key features in geologic interpretation. Then it was thought to explain only certain of the superficial deposits of the Earth's surface. Finally, it was either dismissed as being legendary, or it was interpreted as a local flood in Mesopotamia. thus stripping Noah's flood of all geological consequence. So you may search modern geological textbooks today or reference works from one end of the library to the other and find in every work consulted either absolutely no mention whatsoever of Noah's flood, or else perhaps a patronizing reference in some historical footnote on the rise of modern geology. Now, Bible-believing Christians thus face a serious dilemma. When many thousands of trained geologists, most of them sincere and honest in their conviction of the correctness of their interpretation of the geological data, notice the word interpretation. There's no science, boys and girls, in interpretation. They present an almost unanimous verdict against the biblical account of creation and the flood. It must, of course, feel very reluctant to oppose such a tremendous array of scholarship and authority. On the other hand, when confronted with the biblical evidence for a global flood of tremendous geological potency, the average Joe Sixpack is still more reluctant to reject the Bible's testimony. This is no problem, of course, to men who do not accept the inspiration of the Bible or the authority of Jesus Christ. But the instructed Christian knows that the evidences for full divine inspiration of Scripture, are far weightier than the evidences for any fact of science. When confronted with the consistent biblical testimony to a universal flood, the believer must constantly or certainly accept it as unquestionably true. Now, Christians have attempted to escape this dilemma by various stratagems of harmonization of the Genesis record of creation and the flood with the scheme of uniformitarian historical geology. As far at least as the flood is concerned, the foregoing chapters have demonstrated these attempts to be totally sterile. The decision then must be faced. Either the biblical record of the flood is false and should be rejected, or else the system of historical geology, which has seemed to discredit it, is wrong, and therefore it must be changed, or at least challenged. Now, the latter alternative would seem to be the only one which a biblically and scientifically instructed Christian could honestly take, regardless of the deluge of scholarly wrath and ridicule that takes such a position and which such a position brings upon him. And I want to underline the word ridicule. Hey, wait a minute. Since when is ridicule scientific? You know, if you got something to say, let's talk about it. But let's not sit here and call each other names and ridicule and mock and make fun of. Bring forth your proofs. Bring forth hard evidence. Bring forth facts. And then let's discuss those facts and that hard evidence in conjunction with the flood or in conjunction with the periodic table or with the uniformitarian philosophies or ideas and theories and hypotheses and, yes, interpretations. Now, religious people have interpretations of the Scripture. That's true. And every one of them is unscriptural because the Scripture itself says that the Scripture is of no private interpretation. God is able to speak for himself, believe it or not. He does not need Percy Glove Tonsils, the local public parrot, to preach a sermon and apologize for God. He doesn't need that kind of crap at all. He can speak for himself. He does. He's very straightforward, and he says, let me tell you, boys and girls, I was there, I'm an eyewitness, and I'm giving you my report. And in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9, he gave us the report on the flood, and he didn't stutter once. All right, now with that much out of the way, in context, Dr. Butcher is developing and deploring this lack of practical geologic interest in fossils because of their presumed necessity for interregional and international geologic time correlations. But he is unintentionally thereby admitting that these correlations have little genuine scientific value for the understanding of geology. They're not really fundamental, and it is therefore possible that entirely different schemes of correlation may be worked out, which will be found to fit the facts of geologic science as well as, or better than, those heretofore in fashion. Now, the decision that we have to make is that either the biblical record of the flood is false, or the modern scientific interpretation of the geologic evidence that we have in front of us today is false. No, one or the other. And this concept of we'll try to figure out a way to harmonize the two is just pure nonsense. Pure nonsense. The Bible is true, or evolution is true, but there's no correlation of the two. There is no virgin whore that attaches to the Bible. Now, this position need not mean at all that the actual observed data of geology should be rejected. It is not the facts of geology, but only certain interpretations of those facts that are at variance with the Scripture. Did you get that, boys and girls? Nobody is sitting here arguing about the names of rocks or the facts of geology. We can see it, we can hear it, we can taste it, we can touch it, we can feel it. We know it's there and we know it's true. Those are hard facts. It's the interpretation of those facts that's at variance with the scripture. And the scripture doesn't need any interpretation whatsoever. An interpretation is your view. It's your belief. It is total, pure hearsay. You couldn't bring that into court in a heartbeat. Hearsay is not allowed. We want to be able to see it, hear it, taste it, touch it, or feel it. We don't want to hear about it, and we don't want your opinion. Now, these interpretations involve the principle of uniformity. Uniformity and evolution is a framework for the historical evaluation of the geologic data. But historical geology is only one of the many branches of geologic science and is, for the most part, of scant practical interest to the commercial geologist, who finds it of little use in his search for oil or mineral deposits. Now, Dr. Walter Butcher, he's a professor of geology at Columbia University and past president of the Geological Society of America, and he admits as much when he says that the habit of looking up from the pressing detail of an ore body or an oil pool and seeing it in its regional setting is by no means general among the practical men of our profession. Professional geologists working in the petroleum industry are apt to lose sight of the importance of fossils, for within the confines of one oil field and even one sedimentary basin, the bed tracing by lithologic characters and by electric logging makes fossils totally superfluous. Now, when you're talking about finding oil pools or finding a bed of copper or some mineral, or you're talking about agates or the lava deposits or the flow that came off this mountain, and that's hard facts. I mean, we're talking about reality here. It's when some guy comes along and says, billions and billions of years ago. Who in the hell was there billions and billions of years ago to make these records and to testify to these facts? It's pure fantasy. It's just Alice in Wonderland nonsense. He doesn't know if it's billions or millions or trillions or thousands of years ago. He hasn't got a clue. He has a theory. He has an interpretation. He has a belief. That's fine. People go to church and they're religious and they have beliefs. And they're certainly welcome to it. But it doesn't mean that it's got any shade of truth that is connected with it. I mean, hell, boys and girls, let's be real. If you get 476 religious organizations and they all have different beliefs, can they all be true? Mull it over a little bit. Isn't somebody wrong? Well, my common sense says that you can't have up and down and both of them be the same. One of them is the exact opposite of the other. Noah's flood is the exact opposite to uniformitarianism. Now, it becomes very important, therefore, for Christians to restudy and rethink this great mass of geologic and paleontologic data with two main purposes in view. The first aim should be to examine carefully the currently accepted scheme of historical geology and its guiding principles in order to determine clearly within and to what degree it is, in fact, at variance with the biblical record of creation and the flood. If this scheme is basically fallacious, as we have had to decide it must be, then we need to try to understand why it could be that such a great body of responsible scientists has accepted it to be true. Let me pause right here and ask you this. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, that we had a particular fact. And we'll take a number of people, hypothetical. 1,000 people believe that the fact is positive, and 100 people believe that the fact is negative. Could we determine, based upon the preponderance of opinion, that the fact is positive because 1,000 people believe it and only 100 people believe that it's negative? You know, back in World War II, you had 60 million Germans, and all those Germans believed that Hitler was the greatest thing since sliced white bread. Did it make it true because 60 million Germans believed it? Hell, the majority, the preponderance of public opinion was in favor of Hitler and the Nazis. But did it make it true? See, today we look back on that period of time and say, God, those people were really deceived, weren't they? Well, the same thing is true with Catholicism. You know, all the Protestants look at the Catholics and say, well, those people are truly deceived. The Catholics look at the Protestants and say, look at these heretics. They're truly deceived. It could well be that both of them are deceived and that the truth lies somewhere else, maybe way, way over in Buddha land or in Allah land or in Japan or China or someplace else. But they both can't be right. That's the bottom line. So when we have a controversy, and one side says, hey, listen, we think that it's positive, and there's 1,000 of us that believe it, and that's the majority. That's nonsense. The majority isn't always right. As a matter of fact, the majority is usually always wrong. And if I see somebody in the majority, or if I look at a majority, and we just saw this with the Iraq war, and we all got behind the president, and we said, the president is right about this Iraq war. Now, 2 years later, we look at the president and say, God, that guy lied to us and cheated us and deceived us, and the Iraq war is all wrong. 87% of people now in the United States are opposed to the war. 87%. Hell, it was nearly that much that were in favor of it and after it started. Well, when were you wrong? The old adage goes, well, were you lying then or are you lying now? That's what we use in court. Were you wrong then or are you wrong now? The bottom line is we can be wrong at any particular or given point in time. That's why in judicial practice, we insist upon the rules of procedure. We insist upon the objections. There's 42 of them, remember? We reject out of hand hearsay. We're not going to listen to somebody's opinion. If you can't prove it, shut up. If you've got evidence, bring it in. And let's qualify it, and let's analyze it, and let's see how this evidence fits into the story and whether or not it proves or disproves any particular theory. Now, it will be necessary also to discover the point out of the inadequacies of the scheme from a strictly scientific viewpoint and to show that it is unable to correlate satisfactorily all of the available geologic data. This chapter will attempt to deal primarily with questions of this sort. The second aim, which will be that of the following chapter, will be to develop, if possible, a new scheme of historical geology, which would not only be true to the biblical revelations that are pertinent, but also would serve as a better basis of correlation for the available scientific data than does the present one. These goals are, to put it very mildly, not easily attainable, and it will likely have to be attempted, if at all largely, by men outside the camp of professional geologists. It's likely that many students majoring in the field could survive several years of intensive indoctrination in the uniformitarian interpretation of geology without becoming immune to any other interpretation, and still less likely that they would ever be granted graduate degrees in this field without subscribing wholeheartedly to it. Now, there is an immense amount of data available that must be restudied and then reevaluated, enough to require the attention of many experts for a very long period of time. Considering the dual limitations imposed on the present writers by their lack of broad training in this field and by the lack of available space in this volume, all that is hoped for at present is to develop and to present a plausible preliminary outline study which will stimulate others to further study along the same lines. Put in layman's language, let's prove it. Geological implications of the biblical record. The only proper place to start in the study is with the biblical record of the flood itself, and the following appear to be legitimate inferences from the account. First of all, there was tremendous erosion from rainfall. Do we see tremendous erosion around the world today? Can we observe that, boys and girls? Well, great quantities of water were poured down on the earth from the skies, not in the form of a gentle drizzle, but as a torrential downpour continuing without ceasing for 40 days and 40 nights worldwide, all over the world. Speaking metaphorically, the scriptures say that the floodgates of heaven were opened. This pounding rain would first, by its own impact, begin the work of soil and rock erosion. Modern hydrology has proven that raindrop impact is a very significant factor in the initiation of the erosion phenomenon. Now, as the waters begin to run off to lower levels, already containing a certain amount of sedimentary load to aid in further erosive action by the mechanisms of turbulence and attrition, it would begin to form rivulets. These rivulets would run finally to the nearest stream, but in the process would deepen their own channels by further erosion. This is the way in which great gullies are formed, often to great depths, in a single rainstorm. In the present day, for the uniquely intense rainstorm of the deluge, the combined processes of raindrop impact, sheet erosion, and gully erosion would necessarily have excavated and transported prodigious quantities of earth and rock, even if no other agencies had been available for sediment transfer. The second issue is clouds were not the source of the deluge rains. A global rain continuing for 40 days, as described in the Bible, would have required a completely different mechanism for its production than is available at the present day. If all of the water in our present atmosphere were suddenly precipitated out, it would only suffice to cover the ground to an average depth of 2 inches. The process of evaporation could not have been effective during the rain, of course, since the atmosphere immediately above the earth was already at saturation level. The normal hydrologic cycle would therefore have been incapable of supplying the tremendous amounts of rain that the Bible describes. The implication seems to be that the antediluvian climatology and meteorology were much different from the present time. And there seems to have been an atmospheric source of water of an entirely different type and order of magnitude than now exists on planet Earth today. Number three, in large ocean basins. Whatever the source of the deluge rain, the mass of waters which descended to the earth could hardly have been elevated back into the heavens, because it is not there now. And this can only mean that much of the waters of our present oceans entered the oceans at the time of the flood. This in turn implies that the proportion of land area to water area prior to the flood was much larger than it is today, perhaps very much larger than at present. Much of the present sea bottom was once dry land. Very likely, in order to accommodate the great mass of waters and to permit the land to appear again, great tectonic movements and isostatic adjustments would have to take place, forming the deep ocean basins that we see today and the troughs and elevating the continents at the same time. This seems to be specifically implied in the poetic reflection of the deluge in Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9. And that this passage refers to the flood rather than to the initial creation is evident from the last verse, which refers to God's promise that a world-covering flood would never again be visited upon the earth. Certainly, therefore, the Bible makes it abundantly plain that the events associated with the deluge were of immense geologic potency and must have caused profound geologic changes, far more than you'd find in a local flood down the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. There were volcanic and seismic upheavals. Great volcanic explosions and eruptions are clearly implied in the statement that all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. This must mean that great quantities of liquids, perhaps liquid rocks or magma, as well as water, probably steam, had been confined under great pressure below the surface rock structure of the earth since the time of its formation, and that this mass now burst forth through great fountains, probably both on the land and under the sea. By analogy with present phenomena associated with volcanism, there must also have been great earthquakes and tsunamis, popularly known as tidal waves, generated throughout the world. These eruptions and these waves would have augmented the floodwaters as well as accomplished great amounts of geologic work directly. And number five, the unprecedented sedimentary activity. The entire account plainly yields the inference that tremendous quantities of earth and rock must have been evacuated, excavated by the waters of the flood. Many factors must have contributed to this. The driving rains, the raging steams resulting from them, the earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, the powerful tidal waves, then later the waves and other currents generated by the rising of the lands and the sinking of the basins, and perhaps many other factors which we cannot now even guess. Never since the world was formed could there ever have been such extensive erosion of soil and rock beds on a global scale as it was during the Genesis flood. And the materials that were eroded must eventually have been redeposited somewhere, and necessarily in stratified layers, such as we find everywhere around the world today in the great sedimentary rock systems. We walk around and we view the evidence of the flood, just looking at the strata that's been laid down and then folded or bent, as you see in the Rocky Mountains. Hey, I got to give you a mid-course correction here. Let me give you a reminder, and we'll be right back with more on the Genesis flood right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, history, politics, religion, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, The Genesis Flood, published in 1963, written by two authors, Whitcomb and Morris. Whitcomb and Morris, The Genesis Flood. Still available. 9th printing is the last I've seen, and probably the 15th or 20th by now. This is a college-level geology textbook. It's used in some colleges, colleges that teach the creation account. Most colleges don't, of course. Most universities laugh at the idea. What we're doing here is examining this laughter and mockery to see whether it has any scientific basis. And if it does, then we'll shut up. And if it doesn't, then let's replace it with something that does. Let's get to the facts. Now, the sixth item here in the list, the ideal conditions for forming fossils were created during the flood. Antediluvian fauna and flora seem to have been richer and more varied than in our present world. And this is inferred from our deduction that the land areas were much more extensive than they are at present, and also from the implication that the pre-deluge climate was vastly different. This probability will be discussed in more detail later. Suffice to note at present that with the primary purpose of the deluge being to destroy all life on planet Earth, at least on the dry land, except the Ark's passengers, there must have been uncounted multitudes of living creatures, as well as plants, trapped and eventually buried in the moving masses of sediments, and of course under conditions eminently conducive to fossilization. And never before or since could there have been such favorable conditions for the formation of fossil strata. Now, uniformitarianism is totally undermined by the flood. And finally, in view of the global nature of the catastrophe and the magnitude of the geophysical phenomena accompanying it, it follows that the flood constitutes a profound discontinuity in the normal processes of nature. Any deposits formed before the flood would almost certainly have been profoundly altered by the great complex of hydrodynamic and tectonic forces unleashed during the deluge period. The fundamental principle of historical geology, that of uniformitarianism, however valid it may be for the study of deposits formed since the flood, can therefore not legitimately be applied before that time. This factor is of special importance in the consideration of the so-called absolute geological chronometers, which have been interpreted as giving ages for the various strata and for the Earth itself. You've seen that, what do they call that thing there where they've got all the fossils in the geologic record? We'll come to that a little bit later on. They got a name for that. They got a title. There isn't any place in the world where that geologic record appears. Not a single place. And in fact, as we progress along, we will find a strata that's out of place. In other words, as you look at geology, and you ask the question, when you look at a strata of rock, let's say it's 30 feet thick, and you say, hey, Mr. Geologist, what kind of rock is that? And he says, oh, that's Mesozoic rock. Or he'll tell you it's Jurassic or Cretaceous. Or he'll hang a label on that rock and say, well, how old is that rock, Bob? And he says, well, that's Jurassic rock, and that rock is a billion years old. Wow, a billion-year-old chunk of rock there, 30 feet thick. So you say, well, Bob, does this rock appear under some rock that's on top of it? And he looks up a little bit and says, oh, yeah, and on top of that rock, and they'll hang a label on that rock, and they'll call that Mesozoic or something else. Well, how old is that rock? Oh, that rock is younger than the rock underneath. Oh, yeah. So the rock underneath is a billion years old. How old is this rock on top of it? Oh, well, that rock it's only 700 million years old. Then you say, well, Bob, look down here underneath this rock. How old is that rock? He says, well, that rock is below our rock here, so it's got to be older than a million years old. See the theory? This is what you learned in school now, isn't it, boys and girls? Now follow along here. When you got rock here, and it's a billion years old, the rock on top of it's 700 million. So the rock underneath it has to be older than a billion, so it's a billion 300 million. Now, this same piece of Jurassic rock that you're looking at over here appears in France. But over in France, or Germany, or Japan, or China, someplace else in the world, you come up to this rock over here, and the rock that is the older rock, you know, the 1,300,000,000-year-old rock, it's on top of the Jurassic rock, and then the Mesozoic rock is underneath the Jurassic rock in other parts of the world. Now, how do you explain that, chump? See, I can call names too, see, chump. Now, without the name-calling, without all of the invective that goes along with it, it's pretty obvious that if you've got three types of rock over in the United States, and the three types of rock have been shuffled and they're in a different order someplace else in the world, that they weren't all laid down at the same time. Well, if they weren't all laid down at the same time, then they got different ages. And by calling this rock Mesozoic rock, Jurassic rock, Cretaceous rock, Precambrian rock, or something else, doesn't tell you jack squat about how old it is. Not one iota. That's called interpretation. That's assuming facts, not an evidence. That's just creating a story right out of thin air. It's what we call theories and hypotheses. Nothing scientific about that. That's just somebody's personal opinion, and a lot of other people adopted that opinion, and they're in the majority. But not much of a majority. Did you know that 56% of scientists claim that they believe in evolution and uniformitarianism, and 44% claim that they believe in creationism, and they don't believe in uniformitarianism? Well, it's about as close to 50-50 as you can get. About half the scientists are saying, well, I believe in evolution. The other half say, no, I believe in creation. It's the way that game is played out. So it's not like it's an overwhelming majority, 99-1 or something like that. Seems that way, though. Did you know that the creation account is totally rejected in all of the public education institutions in the country? Name one public education institution in America that teaches creation. Name one. Send me an email, would you? You know where it's at. Now, the religious schools teach creationism, or at least some of them do. I don't know if most of them do, or half of them do. I would imagine that the Catholic high school and the Baptist schools probably teach creationism, which gives us a market here for the Genesis flood in those schools, but there's no need for it at the University of California at Berkeley or Livermore or someplace else. They don't need it. So let's take a look at basic harmony of the field of data and the biblical inferences. You know, all of these biblical inferences from the Bible record are clearly supported in at least a general way by the actual records of the rocks. Almost all of the sedimentary rocks of the earth, which are the ones containing fossils and from which the supposed geologic history of the earth has been largely deduced, have been laid down by moving water. This statement is so obvious and so universally accepted that it doesn't need any further proof or elaboration. Everybody's in agreement. When you're looking at sedimentary rock, it was laid down by water. All right? That's a fact. We can look at the rock, we can say, wow, look at that. And we can take a look today, and it's either one, it was laid down by the continent sinking and rising over great periods of time in a primordial sea, or it was buried by Noah's flood. So there's a fact that we can all agree on. Sedimentary rocks were laid down by water, which the Oxford Universal Dictionary, by the way, defines as earthy or detrital matter deposited by aqueous agency. Obviously, these great masses of sediments must first have been eroded from some previous location. They had to be transported and then deposited, perhaps, of course, more than once, exactly the sort of thing which occurs in any flood and which we have seen must have occurred on a uniquely grand scale during the great flood of Genesis. I mean, everywhere you go, I just came back from the west, and as I'm driving along, the highways cut through the mountains. And all you got to do is look out the window and you'll see layers of rock. They're all laid down by water. Now, picture a worldwide flood. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but just picture this worldwide flood. And this flood is moving that rock, that matter, that material. It had to be eroded from someplace and deposited someplace, then. You go down to northern New Mexico, and you see these buttes out there. Well, sometimes they stick up there 400 or 500 feet. Like down at Shiprock, New Mexico, you drive down. The old highway used to be called 666. Remember old 666? And you're going down 666. I forgot the name of that town down there below Shiprock, but you're going down that road, it's about 150, 200 miles down there. And you look out here on the desert, both sides, and you see these buttes standing up there. Well, the buttes are all at the same elevation. You look out here, and there's 1, 2, 3, 9, 11, all the same elevation. Where the roadbed is, it's been eroded out. That has been scoured out 500 feet. Now, look at all that mass and matter that has been removed. We see that kind of phenomenon in floods all the time. The water erodes the softer material and leaves the harder material there. That's a lot of mass. That's a lot of dirt. And then it was laid down someplace in Nevada or California or some other place. And then you've got tectonic folding of the Earth's crust. You've got mountain building like the Sierras and the Rockies. And then look at those stratas of rock. Sometimes they're sitting or they're standing vertically on edge. Same stratas. Now, you know that those stratas couldn't have been laid on edge. They had to be laid flat and then tilted or bent. When did that happen? And there's a place up here in Canada, 600,000 square miles of rock that's inverted. And they say, well, what must have happened here was it tilted and it slid off, and then the rock underneath it rose up, and then the rock that slid off was somehow slipped back in like a deck of playing cards. And they call that science? My God, you couldn't get Bugs Bunny and the Roadrunner to perform a trick like that in a cartoon. And these people are serious scientists making suggestions like that. And they got a name for it here. Let me see if I can flip through here and see the picture. Hey, it's some kind of an uplift over here. The next program, I think I'll dig that one out, and I'll read you that story over here. Honest to God, these people have PhDs after their names, and they're telling you that 600,000 square miles of this rock was shuffled like a deck of cards? And they call that uniformitarianism, and what's happening today happened in the past, and what's happened in the past is happening today? Come on, boys and girls. Surely, even our common sense has got to tell us better than that. Let's see if I can find a picture here. I just passed one. Nope, not at the picture. I'll dig it out here. 600,000 square miles shuffled like a rock. What a crock of baloney. But you know, you've got to answer the question on Friday's test, and you've got to put that answer in there. If you don't, you're going to flunk the test. And they call that, here it is. It's called the Lewis overthrust contact line. Let me read this to you. The almost perfectly horizontal nature of the Lewis overthrust contact line indicated by the arrow is revealed in the photograph. So I got a picture here. And what this picture displays is a great big thick pile of rock. And underneath it, there's a great big thick pile of rock called strata. And right in between it, there's this contact line, a very thin piece, a very thin layer of strata that's in between it. And the tricky part is that the underlying rock is younger than the overlying rock. And they explain that by telling us that this tilted up on edge and 600,000 square miles of it slipped off. And these rocks became inverted. And this contact line, the 16th of an inch over here, somehow or another didn't get disturbed in the process. Now, what happened was the underlying rock was laid first. The 1/16 inch piece was laid second. And the overlying rock was laid third. And the fact that that strata is in that configuration and conflicts with the same type of rocks that are over in North America or South America is laid down by the flood. It didn't slide off. Now listen to this story here. There is certainly no apparent indication of any substantial amount of shearing distortion along the surface. Slight differential movements on the two sides of the bedding plane, due to differences in the structural characteristics of shale and limestone, have caused some slight distortion, particularly opening up a clear-cut split along the contact. All along the contact line for at least a half a mile, a very thin 1/16 to 1/8 inch layer of shale-like material made of very fine clay particles is found adhering in some places to the upper Algonquian limestone and in some to the underlying Cretaceous shales, which are lithologically quite distinct from the layer itself. It seems inconceivable that this very fine layer would have been left so intact if the limestone had actually been thrust over the shale as the Lewis overthrust interpretation demands. Lewis overthrust, that's called. And this goes under the guise of science. I mean, this is the kind of crap, this is the kind of baloney, this is the kind of propaganda that's promoted in our public institutions, public schools. And your kid goes there, I know I went there, and I looked at this, and I listened to the story, I believed it, just like George Bush. I believed Bush told us the truth about that war thing, and I'll tell you what really convinced me was Colin Powell. You remember Colin Powell went into the United Nations, and he said, hey, listen, let me tell you the story, let me tell you what's going on. And they laid out that story. Well, later on, Colin Powell, after he left the administration, he said, you know, that was false. I believed that it was true. I believed the intelligence. That's what I received, and I thought that was true, but I later found out it was a damn lie. It was old Mark Twain that said, you know, there's lies, there's damn lies, and then there's statistics. Well, I guess this was the statistic level. Lewis overthrust. You'll see that story here in this book called The Genesis Flood. And then there's a picture here of the Matterhorn. You know, there's a lot of these examples of younger rock lying on top of older rock all over the world, and the Matterhorn is one of them. You know, the famous Swiss mountain is only one of many in the Alps that are out of the standard geologic order. The Matterhorn is supposed to have been thrust from some 30 to 60 miles away over younger rocks, with subsequent erosion removing all evidence of its continuity with its source. The strata in the equally famous Mithun Peak of the Alps are, in ascending order, Eocene, Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous, and it was thought to have been pushed all the way from Africa to Switzerland. The Matterhorn pushed from Africa to Switzerland, and there's no evidence of it anywhere. And that's the kind of crap that's being taught in our public schools. You mean to tell me you believe the Matterhorn was moved from Africa and there's no evidence of it anywhere in the rocks? I mean, it ought to have at least created a scar on the land. It should have created a couple of ditches, wouldn't you think? So there's no evidence of such a thing. What in the hell makes you think it came from Africa? Maybe it came from Russia. Hell, maybe it came from France or England. If there's no evidence of its movement, do you think that I'm lying to you here? I'm just reading the pictures under the captions. Let me read it again. It's figure 20. It's called the Matterhorn. This famous Swiss mountain is only one of many in the Alps that are out of the standard geologic order. Whitcomb and Morris didn't come up with the standard geologic order. That's the uniformitarians that did that. That's the evolutionists. They're the ones that tell us, oh, this is Eocene rock, and here's how old that rock is. Oh, okay. Well, what's the next one? Oh, that's Jurassic, and here's how old that rock is. They're the ones that are telling us how old this rock is. And then when you go out here and you actually do your field studies, and you find out that the younger rocks are under the older rocks. How do you explain that? Oh, well, the Matterhorn was shifted up here from Africa. Didn't leave any scars on the land, but we believe that that's the way that had to happen. And these fools call that science, boys and girls. Honest to God, they call that science. Hell, you could get more truth out of a Bugs Bunny cartoon than you can get out of that kind of crap. Honest to God, the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote have got more truth and more science in them than this crap that you're reading in these science textbooks. Ah, shucks. Now, there's more water in the present oceans today than there was in the pre-flood world. There's also much evidence that the sea level was once much lower relative to the land surfaces than it is at the present time. Now, that implies either that the amount of water in the ocean was much smaller, or that some parts of the sea bottom have dropped, or both. In the past decade, it has been discovered that great numbers of seamounts, that's mountains under the ocean, which are nothing but drowned islands out in the middle of the ocean, these are flat-topped and therefore non-volcanic in formation, and are now in many cases more than 1,000 fathoms below the surface. And yet they give abundant evidence of having once been above the surface. Dr. Edwin L. Hamilton, the marine geologist, says concerning them, they're fossil landforms preserved in the depths of the sea, where they're disturbed only by light currents and the slow rain of sediment material from the waters above. And that's what we can observe. That's called hard science. At one time, those seamounts under the ocean were sticking up above the water. And in fact, you can go down to Bimini and you'll see a whole city down there in Bimini with streets and buildings and the whole nine yards under the water. It's about 100 feet underwater. Now, how in the hell did that happen? You mean to tell me those people went down there and built that city under the water? Or did they build that city and the flood came over and buried it? You know, take your choice. Which is the more logical? Somebody built the city underwater, or they built the city and the land subsided, or the water came up and flooded it? Well, for my money, I just look at that as an old farmer over here and say, well, it looks like to me they built it on dry land and it got flooded. Of course, I'm just an old country boy. But that's what my common sense tells me. I'm about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll be back tomorrow. I think I'll tell you that story tomorrow about that Lewis overthrust. That's a funny story. But let me leave you with a parting reminder that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by pre-arrangement. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like to know more about it, then why don't you call and ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, it's free of charge. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. I'm going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.